going to call the first case of 00-1739 and the termination of parental rights to Jason S. Timothy A. Provost, counsel for Chickala S. Is that the correct pronunciation of any
yes,
of those names? Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. I am Tim Provost, and I wrote Petitioner Tequila's briefs. Now, when a case is set for argument, I imagine that reviewing judges are somewhat trepidatious about whether appellate counsel will ponderously pontificate upon points previously presented on paper in the briefs.
How long did you work on that,
So I want to reassure the court about that. I studied oral argument with late Justice Goldberg of the U.S. Supreme Court, and his first rule was of oral argument was sit down. So I plan to use up nowhere near all of my time and just try to get right to the part of the point.
We may use some of it, too.
Yes, Your Honor. It's perhaps not well known that the great Samuel Johnson, the dictionary writer, was also a lawyer. And on the subject of precedents, Boswell records that he once said, "The more precedents there are, the less occasion is there for law. That is to say, the less occasion is there for investigating principles." So, if everything is working right, a case doesn't get to this level unless there are no precedents, so we can spend the whole time talking about principles. There's two principles, kinds of principles in this case, statutory interpretation principles and constitutional principles. And for petitioner, it's really a simple case, applying the plain meaning rule to the sentence from the statute. The statute, default statute, is 806.02(5). And the final sentence is, if proof of any fact is necessary for the court to render judgment, the court shall receive the proof. So from petitioner's point of view, it's just a question of applying the plain meaning rule here. The Constitution says, according to Santusky versus Kramer, that clear and convincing evidence must be taken to support finding of unfitness, and the plain meaning rule applied to that sentence from the statute. Sentence says it's necessary, and Santosky says it's necessary.
But here, counsel, just so that I have the record correct, your client missed at least two hearings, and in fact, they had a jury selected for April 3rd, and that, as I recall looking in the record, that jury was then sent home because she...
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor. Yeah. First time. And then the second time, there, yes. There.
And she apparently...
Your Honor, excuse me, I hate to interrupt, but maybe with my age, my hearing is going, but could you speak up just...
Well, she missed at least two hearings.
Yes, Your Honor.
And one where the jury was then excused. That was the April 3rd. If I'm not mistaken. And then it was reset, and then she appeared. She didn't appear. She then phoned in.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And it would seem to me that by doing this, are you saying that at some point in time, the person always has to be there to elicit this information, to elicit, to perform for the Constitution or the statutory requirements? There is no time when the judge can simply say, look, you've had an adequate opportunity and you're going to lose your rights.
Oh, no. Yeah. My view of the case is, at a minimum, the judge must take some kind of evidence. Here, I would assume that the petitioner herself would have been called to testify to the facts that would support finding by clear and convincing evidence of unfitness. That's all I'm saying is, sure, the jury was there waiting. I appreciate all that. But I don't see where it's a tremendous burden when everyone is all assembled for the trial for the judge to satisfy him or herself that there are facts supporting the petition.
And there were facts. And there were facts supporting the petition as far as her not having contact with the child for a number of years. All of those were in the record.
Well, there was some testimony. The respondent has referred to some testimony that Evelyn C.R. gave at a plea hearing. And they were trying to decide, the court was trying to decide at that point who was she a legal guardian and could she be a petitioner now? And the respondent has included that at the end of her appendix, or two pages of at the end of her appendix. Now, I reviewed that. I don't see where, I see where that shows that the child was with the petitioner. I don't see where it shows it would be clear and convincing evidence that my client had abandoned anyone. Plus, I would argue that that shouldn't be considered because neither party had counsel at that point. And certainly my client wasn't on notice that this testimony that petitioner was giving was going to be used to find her unfit. So I...
Counsel, isn't it significant that at the dispositional hearing there was testimony presented by the grandmother and by a school counselor, and that testimony basically would have clearly indicated abandonment? Now, I recognize that's at the dispositional hearing, but under all the circumstances, don't you have a harmless error situation?
Well, no, Your Honor. I don't believe that because, as I've said in the briefs, that's just like saying, well, if we don't have evidence at a criminal trial for sufficient beyond reasonable doubt to convict, well, if we get it at sentencing, that's okay. I mean, the person's opportunity to contest or present evidence is on the finding that they have been bad, that they should be punished, has already been made by the time of disposition.
Well, if you look at the Brittany Ann case that we decided last term,
yes, Your Honor.
How do you distinguish that case from this case? Because that case basically said, looking at the entire record, it was harmless error. The testimony was not presented.
Your Honor, in that case, the father had already made a knowing and voluntary waiver of his rights, which was sufficient by the Bangard standard. At least this court found in review of it was sufficient for voluntary and intelligent.
That related to the voluntary waiver, but the court went on to say, I think, that the statute there requires that there'd be testimony. Mm-hmm. And that there wasn't testimony in that case at the appropriate time, at the appropriate hearing. But then the court went on to say that when you looked at all of the record in that case, there was testimony from which you could, and the court used the word teased out, mm-hmm. sufficient factual evidence. So it was more, Brittany H. was more than a Bangard case. It was a case that said there wasn't a factual hearing as required by the statute, but that you'd look at the whole record to do that. Now, what would you have wanted the judge to do in this case? You wanted a jury hearing, right?
No, Your Honor. I believe what the minimum that due process requires...
No. Let's go back. What should the judge have done? There was a request for a jury trial.
Mm-hmm.
Your client doesn't show. Should the jury trial have proceeded?
I don't think she was required to do that, no, Your Honor.
Who's she?
That's Judge Sumi, who's sitting here.
So what did you want the judge to do then? Should the judge have said, okay, there's no jury trial, there's going to be a trial to the court?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe... I guess it's true, Your Honor. I have sort of deliberately left open the possibility that this court might rule that way, but I don't believe that that's the minimum that due process requires.
Okay, well, let me tell you my problem, okay? I view termination of parental rights a very serious business. Very serious business for the parent who's going to lose a child, and a very serious business for the child. The child will lose a parent, but the child also has the opportunity to get security and finality of relationships, and that's viewed as very important, and permanent placement, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So my interest as a judge is to have these statutes that protect all of these interests be applied in a prompt, fair way. So I may get assigned this case, and I may have to write it, right? So I want to know, and I want to be able to tell the Court of Appeals and the trial judges of the state what they're supposed to do, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So what was the judge supposed to do from your perspective?
Well, I'll give you an example. I do a lot of these kinds of cases on appointment, and there's a judge who's been on the bench considerably longer than this one was up in Green Bay, whose transcript I read last week. And the client was in the slammer or somewhere out of state and decided that he didn't want to show up, and so the judge decided to default him on the TPR. So before entering the finding, the judge put the social worker on the stand and took testimony from the social worker. Now, I might, I suppose, be able to make an argument in that case that the social worker's testimony wasn't clear and convincing evidence, but that would be my only argument. The evidentiary facts to support the petition were put on when the social worker testified. And for me, that's sufficient, and so I already have filed a no merit in that case.
All right. With a jury or without a jury in this case?
The case I was speaking of in...
I know, but I'm talking about this case. What was the trial judge supposed to do in this case?
I don't believe a jury is necessary, Your Honor, no.
Okay, so, but you did ask for a jury, or at least...
She did, yes.
She being your client.
Yes.
All right. So then the judge, you would say no jury because your client's not there.
You could view this as, you know, a sanction for default, or you could view it as, well, she has to be found in contempt, but she has, I think, waived her right to put on her own evidence by not showing up when she was warned. But as far as I say, the minimum would be some evidentiary facts should support the complaint. I suppose I could throw in, I put this final case, Sibley versus Weinberg, in the reply brief, and that's a almost 100-year-old case in which the court was trying to decide what the intent of a predecessor statute to this default statute was. And basically they just said that, well, the judge has discretion to do what's necessary, which is what the statute now says. But what I found most interesting about that case was this court, 100 years ago, took the time to mention that it was the practice of circuit courts at that time to exercise discretion in favor of insisting on evidentiary facts, even in ordinary property cases.
Yes, sir. What would be accomplished in this case were we to send it back? I mean, we know that the evidence is that the mother did not even try to find the child for, what, 5 or 6 years, even though the child was easily, she knew where the child was, had no contact with the child at all. So go back, that's the evidence that the judge is going to have in front of her. What possible good is going to be done by sending it back? I mean, for the mother, and most particularly for the child. At least as I recall reading one of these briefs, the child was quite distraught at the potential that his life was going to be disrupted one more time. And the judge took that into account immediately, I believe, signed the adoption paper. So what good that comes from sending this back?
Well, looking at that, Your Honor, purely from the totally biased standpoint of the petitioner, she would get a chance to put on a good cause defense if she can.
Well,
there is a defense to abandonment of good cause in the statute. So I don't know if that answers the question you were asking. I always have trouble, but I feel like I'm on the witness stand when I do these, and I'm trying to figure out where the questioner's going to. So please.
Sometimes we don't even know.
If you let me follow up some inquiry earlier advanced by the chief. She was asking, what would you require? And I understood your response to be a minimum showing, calling the social worker to prove the factual allegations of abandonment. That's what I understood your response to be. Number one, is that essentially your response?
Well, it wouldn't have to be the social worker. In this case, I'm assuming it would be the petitioner, but just someone to testify to evidentiary facts.
Now, let me interrupt.
Yes, Your Honor.
I want to know if you are advancing that based on a statutory right or statutory construction, or are you advancing that on constitutional grounds of due process, or both?
Both, Your Honor.
Okay. Now, why are you advancing that procedure under the statute? Where do you get that from?
There's a statute, Your Honor, which I don't know offhand. I think it's 4833 that says clear and convincing evidence has to be...
4831, okay.
That says clear and convincing evidence has to be taken at the fact-finding here.
And you take from 4831 that it is sufficient to have what, let me use by shorthand, a summary hearing. That's where you get your statutory authority.
Yes, Your Honor. In a default situation like this, yes, that's what I'm saying. A summary hearing is sufficient. I mean, the burden, I guess that's one of the main points I'm saying here. What is the other side complaining about? Everybody is there ready for trial. All the witnesses are there. The burden is only to put one witness on, take 5 minutes of testimony, assuming that's sufficient to satisfy the court that it's clear and convincing, and that's it. Doesn't take any more time than everyone's already there and ready for a whole trial. In fact, it's shorter than a trial by a whole heck of a lot.
Let me follow up on one additional question in a different area. And that deals with the court's prior case of Brittany or Stephen H. or whatever name you want to give to the case. Questions were advanced regarding that, and it's clear that this case, Brittany or Stephen H., is statutory. That is, based on the voluntary procedure for TPR. You look at that procedure, there are certain rights, and then... So this case, I think, or that case rather, was written and decided without any constitutional implications or discussion. It concluded that you can look at the entire record and it was harmless error. Does the fact that this case advances constitutional questions, or you're advancing them, in any way negate the what seems to be rather compelling authority of the Brittany case?
By your last phrase there, I don't think the Brittany case applies here at all.
Okay.
Because the constitutional considerations needn't have been discussed because father made a voluntary intelligent waiver, at least this court found so, that met the constitutional standard. Here there was no such thing. So, this is a statutory interpretation case, but the Constitution has to be involved because it sets the minimum floor on what the statute can do, what can be done under the statute.
In that case, you have a specific statute. That is, when you go the voluntary route, under 48422, when you go the voluntary route, sub 3 says, if the petition is not contested, the court shall hear testimony in support of the allegations in the petition, including testimony as required by sub 7. Sub 7 requires the court to make inquiries satisfactory to establish that there's a factual basis for the admission. That's in the voluntary record.
Yes, Your Honor.
Should that, those statutes be applied in the involuntary route?
Well, I wouldn't, if I were writing the opinion, I wouldn't put it that way, but yes, I would say that the Constitution puts a minimum floor on what can be done under the default statute in a TPR case, and yes, that procedure would be acceptable. That procedure would meet the minimum floor. I wouldn't say that, yes, what I am saying here is the discretion of the judge is limited by the Constitution.
The constitutional rights can be forfeited by conduct, can they not?
Well, yes, Your Honor.
And so why shouldn't your client, assuming that there's a statutory right under Chapter 48 to a fact-finding hearing, and there's a constitutional due process right implicated here, can't your client, and why shouldn't she, be held to have forfeited her statutory and constitutional rights by her default?
Well, Your Honor,
I mean, this is not like a criminal case, right to jury trial, right to counsel.
Well, that's the thing, Your Honor.
Like a finished counsel for which there must be a knowing and intelligent and voluntary waiver explicitly accepted or taken. This is not that sort of a thing. This is a forfeiture by her conduct in defaulting.
Well, except I disagree with what the court has said as far as, number one, I don't like the idea of using a criminal analogy. But
I don't either, and I'm suggesting that we should.
Because most of the clients here are not necessarily criminals. Nevertheless, because the higher courts have delineated the interest involved as more precious than any property right, this is not like a civil case either. And so I disagree with the implication in your question, Your Honor, that a voluntary intelligent waiver is not necessary. She got a written order from the court. Now, we do these plea questionnaire of waiver right forms in criminal cases all the time. To me, the only way that written order could have amounted to sufficient knowledge of her rights was if if you went through the whole thing with the initials on the rights and attorney explained this to me, etc.
So saying that when she missed the 28th, they set a jury trial, I believe, for February 28th, and the court then said we'll adjourn it, but issued an order which specifically warned her about her failure to appear could result in a default judgment and that the consequence would be termination of parental rights. Is that what was actually issued by the judge?
Yes. In one place the order says may, and the other place it seems to say, well, this is going to happen.
But
she had that written order, but now she was still contesting up to that point. What I'm saying is what she waived by her failure to appear is the same as in a criminal case. What you waive is your right to put on defense. Or actually, I guess in a criminal case, you can even still put on defense. But here I'm saying the minimum is one witness who provides evidentiary facts to support the petition.
Which the court had from, in reading it in the red brief, there's seems to be sufficient testimony as to the factual basis for what he's going to
do. Your Honor, at that plea hearing, I disagree that that was sufficient for finding abandonment, certainly by clear and convincing. And I also disagree because client did not have counsel at that point and was not on notice that that testimony would be used to find her unfit.
So the process you're recommending to the court is that your client loses her rights, but that someone has to come on after the fact, after the jury trial, namely, the 11th of April, and put on the record the factual basis in order to give the judge a sufficient basis to...
Yes, Your Honor, factual basis is what I'm...
Counsel, why wasn't the petition itself sufficient? Wasn't the petition presented to the trial judge and didn't use that in making the final...
Yes, respondents is argued... Excuse me, Your Honor. I'm trying to speed things up because I got this yellow...
Sure, I know.
Particularly the guardian has honed in on the fact that, well, petitioner, I have a stop. Should I answer this question?
You should answer.
There was an affidavit, which was really a verification of the allegations in the petition. That's what I learned in law school was those are what are called ultimate facts, conclusions of law. There's no evidentiary facts presented by a verification, even in an ordinary civil case. So I don't see how, in a termination of parental rights case, or a criminal case for that matter, I don't see how any documentary evidence can be sufficient to be clear and convincing. It's got to be tested. It's got to be testimony that's tested by cross-examination, is my view of it.
So your idea of a hearing is that someone comes in and then you as counsel with your client not there, you're going to then cross-examine the person who's on the stand.
If the judge decides to take testimony from one witness or however many witnesses the judge feels is necessary for clear and convincing evidence, yes, I believe a client has the right to cross-examine. She hasn't waived that.
What would client not do?
I mean, well, the attorney is there to cross-examine. In this case, the attorney was there.
Yeah.
What would the judge do if the counsel not only cross-examined, but decided that they wanted to offer other witnesses?
Well, my view of the minimum requirement under due process is that the judge only needs to find clear and convincing evidence. So, client has waived her right to testify herself and waived her right to put on her evidence. Well, by not showing up.
I heard you say that before, but then you responded to Justice Babich that the value of remanding this is that you get to put on a defense.
Well, I'm assuming that the next time client's going to show up. I mean, if I have anything to say about it, she will.
But she's already waived.
Counsel, in your brief, you argued that what she gave up was her right to be present in person, not her right to put forth a defense.
That's true. I did not, like I said, that was where I deliberately tried to leave it open for the court to rule way in my favor. But I believe that there's a minimum due process requires under the statute, and it does restrict the discretion of the judge, and it does require the judge to take some evidentiary facts which that judge believes is clear and convincing.
One more question.
Yes, sir.
At least.
Well, I'm already over, but I guess it's up to you guys.
That's what we say.
I'm struck by the statutory scheme here. The termination, the order of termination, is not entered until after the dispositional hearing. Now, at the dispositional hearing, does she have the right to cross-examine witnesses, and et cetera? She was there by telephone or something, wasn't she?
Yes, Your Honor.
Could she contest any of the stuff that went on at the dispositional
hearing? Oh, I agree. She still has a right to present any evidence she wants at disposition.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then why isn't the disposition, I mean, it strikes me that the disposition of hearing is almost the same, if not the same, as the QPR hearing.
Because she's already been found unfit, Your Honor, and being in this state, to cure a default requires her to go through some extra hoops to get her right back to contest her unfitness.
Thank you, counsel. You have several minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I have a sharing of the next 30 minutes between Teresa Redder, representing Evelyn C.R., and Janet Rasmussen, the guardian ad litem. And before you begin, counsel, I want to introduce some people who have come into the courtroom. And they are the Baraboo High School mock trial team. And if that team would stand, please. Well, we're delighted to have you with us this morning. The Baraboo High School mock trial team is here with the State Bar and Wisconsin Supreme Court Court with Class program. This program invites high schools from all over the state to come, listen to an oral argument, and meet with a justice of the Supreme Court during the lunch hour. And the high school mock trial team is part of the State Bar and a national program on mock trial. And I assume, are you preparing for next year or have you prepared for this year?
Don't all speak at once.
That's right. Okay. You're looking forward to next year. Well, good. Well, we hope that we get to see you. We see the two finalists in argument here. Well, thank you very much for coming. They have received materials about this case so that they are prepared to listen intelligently. And they will meet at noon with Justice Bradley. Justice Bradley is the justice who sits three down. Maybe that's a good opportunity to introduce the court. So we'll start with Justice Bradley, Justice Prosser on the far right, and then Justice Bradley, with whom you'll meet. And to my immediate right is Justice Babbage. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Wilcox. And to his left, Justice Crooks, and on the far left, Justice Sykes. Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I am Teresa Roeder of the Madison Law Firm Stafford Rosenbaum. I am here today representing Evelyn, the paternal grandmother of Jaytan. After raising Jaytan for most of his life, Evelyn filed a petition seeking to terminate Tequila's parental rights so that she could adopt Jaytan. This case, as you know, is not about Evelyn. This case is about Tequila's abandonment of Jaytan and her abandonment of the due process rights that the trial court provided her in this case. Tequila abandoned Jaytan for 7 years and then refused to come to court after we begged her to do so. She was given opportunity after opportunity by the trial court, and she failed to take advantage of that. Now she complains that the trial court didn't do enough. She received abundant due process in this case. She had notice of the allegations against her. She had multiple opportunities to come to court and defend against those allegations. And she was represented by counsel appointed by the state of Wisconsin at every stage of these proceedings. When she didn't appear at the very first trial that she had requested, the judge, acknowledging the significant rights that are at stake in this case, with a jury in the courthouse waiting for voir dire to begin, with the attorneys there, the witnesses there, with everybody else there, said, wait, we're not going to do this today. We're going to give Tequila another opportunity to show up and to come and defend against these allegations. The trial court sent the jury home, rescheduled the trial. But the trial court put Tequila on notice. The trial court said, you've got to be here. You've got to come to court and defend against these allegations because these rights are so important. Well, because
counsel indicates to us that opposing counsel that we discussed these rights, but that because Tequila was not there, that she should have the opportunity to sign off, in other words, to initial, that she understood that she had to be there at the next hearing, which was April 3rd. What's wrong with that? It's sort of like understanding all of your rights and that you have to be here. He complains, or at least indicates, that maybe she didn't know what the significance of the next hearing was.
In this case, Your Honor, what ended up happening was when she didn't show up the first time, the trial court considered the options. The trial court considered having her appear by telephone and proceeding with the trial that day. Her attorney was there, the jury was ready, everyone else was ready. But knowing that the facts alleged in this case dealt with abandonment, which means that a parent has failed to visit or communicate with a child for a minimum period of 6 months or failed to communicate about the child with the caregiver, the court stepped back and said, it's too prejudicial. You can have a jury sitting here listening to this evidence, but if the parent isn't here, when the only allegation is abandonment, any warning would not be enough. So the trial court exercised discretion to give Tequila another opportunity. And when that happened, under the proper inherent power of the court to control the way the evidence is presented in their courtroom, to control how cases are held, the court issued an order and gave her the warnings. And when we got to the second trial, when she wasn't there, the trial court simply did what the trial court said it was going to do. It entered the order under the default judgment. And at that point, taking evidence would have been a fruitless effort. Tequila wasn't there. She wasn't even there by telephone that time.
Well, but look, you do have somebody else that no one's talked about yet that has rights here and who has a very important interest in termination of parental rights, and that's the child. So for protection of the child, it seems to me that you have to make sure, well, I should say the state, by statute, is trying to make sure that the child's rights are protected. So even if the parent is careless and neglectful, a child's rights are protected. So why wasn't it necessary to take testimony and prove up a case?
As this court's aware, the juvenile court is a statutory court, and there are three distinct hearings. The termination of parental rights judgment wasn't entered until the very final hearing, the dispositional hearing.
But the first hearing relates to what? What statute governs it here?
The first hearing is governed by Section 48.422, sub 1. It's the initial hearing, and it's required to be held within 30 days from the filing of the petition.
Okay.
And then, after the initial hearing, the court...
What does that hearing do?
The purpose of that hearing is to find out if the parent is contesting the allegations in the petition.
Okay.
When you get to the second hearing, the fact-finding...
And what was found out at the first hearing? Is there a contest here?
Yes. In the very first hearing in this case, Tequila and Evelyn showed up both unrepresented. The guardian ad litem was there, and the judge did take some initial testimony.
Okay. So we're under 422.2 as a contested hearing. Okay, then what happens?
Then you move to fact-finding, and you only have 45 days to schedule that from the initial hearing.
And now we're under 424?
No. Well, the issues that are to be held are addressed in that section.
Okay.
What you need to look at, 424 discusses those when it's a contested case.
Right.
And we were at fact-finding, and there was no person showing up and contesting the allegations.
Right. So it says that the fact-finding hearing should be conducted as in 48.31, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
All right. And what does that say that the judge has to do?
48.31 indicates that the court needs to make a finding in that case that relates to the allegations in the petition and to determine whether the petition is proved by clear and convincing evidence.
That's right. That's 488.31.1. Okay. So, fact-finding hearing means a hearing to determine if the allegations in a petition are provided by clear and convincing evidence. So, what should have been done here? What was done? We can start with that.
What was done in this case is that when we got to fact-finding, the first fact-finding on February 28th, we attempted to proceed. And the court determined it would be too prejudicial to proceed without the petitioner present.
All right. Now we get to the second hearing.
Correct.
She's not there. Okay, what was done, what should have been done?
What was done is that the trial court entered an order at the first hearing, and the party, Tequila, was in violation of that order. The court then moved on because, as this court pointed out, a child's rights were also to be considered in this case. This is, the statutes require that we move these cases along. And
so I understand that, but the statute says you have to have a hearing, and the statute says that the court's job is to determine whether the allegations are proved by clear and convincing evidence.
And they were. What this court knew is that termination did not occur at the fact-finding. What this court was aware of is that there's a whole other hearing, the dispositional hearing, where evidence is again taken and where the court actually makes the final determination about whether a party's parental rights will be terminated or not.
Okay. But there was no hearing to determine under 48.31, there was no hearing to determine whether or not the allegations were proved by clear and convincing evidence. Is that right?
Not at the fact-finding stage.
Okay. So now we're at the third stage, right?
That's okay. Correct.
What's that?
That's 48.426 governs the dispositional factors that are to be considered.
That's after 48.31.7 refers you into a dispositional hearing, right?
That's correct.
All right. So now we're at what?
48.424.
Okay.
And actually 48.426, Your Honor, which All talks right. about what the court needs to consider at the dispositional phase. What is the evidence, what is relevant, what can be presented.
Okay. So theoretically under 48.31.4, the court could have made a finding of fact and a conclusion of law relating to the allegations and found abandoned, right?
At the dispositional hearing?
At the fact-finding hearing.
Theoretically.
Well, it says, well, I don't know why I said theoretically. It says under 4, court or jury shall make findings of fact, and the court shall make conclusions of law relating to the allegations of a petition filed under 48.13, blah, 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 right?
Correct.
Okay. Now we're at 48.424. All right.
When you get to the dispositional hearing, it is an entirely new hearing. Essentially, as this court pointed out in their decision in the interest of KDJ in 1991, that after the fact-finding, when the court makes a finding of unfitness, which gets you to the dispositional phase, that then the court has the discretion to determine what unfitness means, that the term unfitness actually has a spin to it. The spin is the fact that the trial court then needs to consider the facts, the circumstances, everything surrounding what relates to the child and what relates to the situation that is being alleged here. In our scheme, our statutory scheme, a parent can be found unfit at the fact-finding, and yet their rights may not be terminated, and that happens. In this case, it was the trial court's discretion then at that phase to listen to the evidence. And Tequila actually appeared at that trial by telephone and had an opportunity to testify. Her attorney was there as well and had an opportunity to ask questions. This was a case where the court got the evidence, had all of the evidence, before the final judgment was entered in this case.
Is it your position, then, that that dispositional hearing constitutes the default judgment prove-up hearing under the default judgment statute?
Yeah, under the default judgment statute, what the last sentence says is that if proof of any fact is necessary before entering judgment, it shall be taken. And the trial court did just that at the dispositional hearing, took all the evidence.
Counsel, then, is it your position that under the default judgment statute, specifically that last sentence of the statute that refers to if any fact is necessary to prove up, I'm paraphrasing it. Is it your position that in a default for a TPR that there is a necessary fact to prove up or there are necessary facts to prove up before there can be a termination of parental rights?
I think it is necessary to take evidence and have information. In this case, we had a unique situation. The judge did have evidence from that very initial hearing before she ever got to disposition.
Is it necessary that there be a finding based on clear and convincing evidence?
At which stage, Your Honor?
You're suggesting to me that you can get that from that initial hearing, or you can get it from the dispositional hearing, or you can get it from anywhere. I'm not sure that's accurate, but let me assume that it is. And my question is, does that have to be too clear and convincing standard?
Yes, it does. Yes. That is constitutionally mandated, and I think that we need to have that level of proof before you can take such a drastic step as terminating parental rights.
When you say it's constitutionally mandated, is it your position that due process requires a fact-finding hearing before parental rights can be terminated, and that the fact-finding hearing has to be with clear and convincing evidence?
It's my position, and it's our position, from my client's perspective, that you have to have some evidence in the record. It doesn't necessarily have to be specifically at fact-finding. If there is no one there contesting the allegations, when you get to fact-finding.
I'm sorry for interrupting. With regard to due process, what does due process require? Does due process require a fact-finding hearing before parental rights are terminated, and that the fact-finding hearing be to a clear and convincing standard?
Due process requires that there be clear and convincing evidence in the record before a judgment terminating parental rights is entered.
Sure. One of the problems I'm having is a prior case, a 1994 case, the Court of Appeals, Wong.
1984.
Anyway, case of the Court of Appeals, and Judge Anderson wrote it, and he indicates in that case, it was a summary judgment proceeding on a TPR, and the TPR was contested. Walworth County asked that there be summary judgment entered, and the Court of Appeals ended up concluding, and the grounds was abandonment, by the way, and in that summary judgment case, the Court of Appeals concluded that parents have a fundamental liberty interest and that due process entitles, in that case, Elizabeth, to a fact-finding hearing before her parental rights were terminated. Is it your position that the fact-finding hearing here, that requirement can be met by the testimony at the dispositional hearing in any place in the record then?
I'm assuming you're talking about the case in the interest of Philip W.
That's exactly it.
Okay. And in that case, they did talk about summary judgment. Summary judgment is very different from default judgment. What we have here...
I know the difference between summary judgment and default judgment, but I don't know the difference between those two procedures when it comes to the due process requirement of having a fact-finding hearing.
I believe, and it's, and we think that the appropriate steps to protect due process were provided by the trial court in this case, that you don't have to have a pro forma fact-finding hearing when there would be no purpose to it, when there's no one to contest the allegations, when there's nothing else that is being presented, when there's no other witnesses to bring forth, when you can't present any other evidence besides the petitioner, who is going to give the exact same testimony at the next hearing, which is statutorily required before you can enter a judgment terminating parental rights.
What about the opportunity for cross-examination?
The opportunity for cross-examination has been present in this case, and in this case certainly, and in most cases, we have a parent who is represented by counsel. At any time, counsel could have asked questions or requested that testimony. That wasn't done in this case until the final hearing, when Tequila was present by telephone and had a chance to testify.
Well, let me put it this way. Suppose at the final dispositional hearing, no one testified, and the judge entered a dispositional order, terminated parental rights, etc. Would that be valid?
Your Honor, can I ask you to repeat the question?
Yeah. What I'm doing is saying that the judge would take no testimony, no one has heard from at the dispositional hearing.
Okay.
And the judge enters an order finding that grounds for abandonment, termination of parental rights, and makes a dispositional order. Is that going to be adequate under the statutes?
I don't think it is. I don't think there is clear and convincing evidence then.
Okay. So, if I understand your argument is that under 48.424, I better be careful, under the 48.31 fact hearing, right?
Right.
Finding hearing. If that stood alone, it's inadequate.
Correct.
Okay. That what is inadequate about it is that there has not been proof, by clear and convincing evidence, of the allegations. The allegations standing alone are not sufficient.
Correct.
Okay. That this defect or this omission is cured by the dispositional hearing. Because at that hearing, in your opinion, there has been evidence introduced with both the with the mother present by counsel and present by phone, with an opportunity to cross-examine, with an opportunity to present testimony, and that cures any omission from the prior hearing.
Correct.
Okay, so what evidence was introduced?
The evidence that was introduced was the fact that not only had Tequila not had any...
Who's testifying?
Evelyn was testifying, and in addition we had testimony from Megan, the social worker. Your Honor, I have the...
I know, but you may answer my
question. Thank you. We had Megan, the social worker from Jaytons Elementary School, who also testified at that hearing. And all they had to show was that that Tequila had not had any contact with or about Jaytan for a period of 6 months. What the evidence showed here was that it had been years since she had had any contact. Tequila was given an opportunity to testify to rebut that testimony and to also show that even if she couldn't rebut it, that she had good cause for not having contact. She didn't give that testimony. She didn't give
anything. She expressly asked that.
Pardon?
Was she expressly asked whether she had good cause?
No.
Okay. But she gave no good cause.
She gave no good cause.
And the judge made findings of fact?
The judge made findings based on the standards and factors that are in the statute, based on the grounds alleged and based on the things that are necessary to consider at the dispositional hearing.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Rasmussen, you are guardian ad litem for Jayton S.
Chief Justice Abrahamson, Justices of the Court, I'm Janet Rasmussen. I'm the guardian ad litem for Jayton. Jayton has a home with his grandmother. Jayton has a family with his grandmother. And his grandmother, Evelyn, is doing exactly what the Children's Code mandates. She's putting Jayton's interests first and foremost. Jayton has the opportunity to have a stable family, security, and permanence, what every child deserves. Today, I'm asking you to put Jayton's interests first and foremost. This is a case of first impression, the use of default in termination proceedings. As such, you'll be setting a precedent for me as a practicing guardian ad litem to follow. In reviewing this case, I ask you to consider the following. First, Jayton has waited long enough. All of his life, he has waited for his mother to be a parent. This is an unreasonable amount of time for any child to wait. Second, this trial court accommodated the mother, gave the mother the opportunity to be heard while Jayton's childhood ticked away. Parents' rights don't exist in a vacuum. The trial court must have the discretion to use default judgment. And in using the default judgment, the trial court then is looking at the best interests of the child and moving the process along.
I have difficulty about the default judgment. One, I can understand a trial court ordering her to be present, and I can understand saying, well, if you violate the order, that's contempt, and your penalty is default. But default to me always meant nobody showed up, not the client, not the litigant, not the lawyer. Here, the client doesn't show up, and it's a very important case for the client to have shown up, obviously, and very significant in the statutory scheme. But the lawyer is present. I mean, how come that's a default?
In this case, the court, and I believe that the court was looking at meaningfully participating. And in this case, the court did recognize that the attorney was there. The attorney argued and stated at the time of the jury selection, this would be prejudicial. I do not wish to proceed without my client present. So the attorney and the judge agreed with that. And quite frankly, I agreed with that as the guardian ad litem. And that in
because
and of...
Because it was a jury trial or under any circumstances?
I'm sorry?
Because it was a jury trial or under any circumstances?
I think you bring up a good point, which is that it could be under any circumstances, potentially. I think this is a area, default is to the discretion of the trial court. And we have to look at whether the trial court properly exercised discretion.
Even if there's a default, the trial court must take evidence, doesn't it?
Must take evidence on what?
Trial court must take evidence to determine whether grounds exist for termination of parental rights.
Which statute are you referring to? 424?
48.424. You can
correct.
Read it under 48.31. All of them say that you've got to take testimony and make findings.
I would agree that the court has to make findings. I would argue that this case was not, we were not at a fact-finding hearing. You do not necessarily have to proceed to fact-finding when there is a default. The default in and of it...
Then you differ with Ms. Redder.
I do.
Okay.
I do.
That's what I'm trying to find out.
Yes, and I absolutely, I think what's important to understand here Justices, is default happens at various stages in these proceedings. At the initial hearing under 424, if there is notice and a parent does not show up, there's some unpublished cases where a parent has not shown up and they did enter a default.
Now, Counsel, I'd like to, there's some discrepancy with regard to these prior proceedings and who showed and who didn't show, and I just want to clear that up for the record. It's my understanding from co-counsel's brief that, and you were there, at that very first hearing on the petition, you appeared and the mother and grandmother appeared. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And then I'm looking at the order terminating parental rights, and the court has set out the dates and appearances. It indicates the next appearance, and that was November 2, the hearing on petition. The next hearing was November 24, and it indicates that the mother was there in person and by counsel. Mm-hmm. Is that your
That is correct.
The next hearing is a month later, December 21, and it indicates that the mother there is there at that hearing. I guess that's a pretrial conference, in person and by counsel. Is that correct?
That is not correct. I believe the record shows, and if you look at the transcript at the pretrial on December 21st, Tequila appeared by telephone.
Okay. And I'm glad she appeared, but she appeared by phone on that one. Okay. Then you have another hearing, February 17th, which is also a pretrial conference, and she appeared by phone and by counsel at that one.
That is incorrect. At that hearing, Tequila's number, the court attempted to reach her, and she was not available. That's the February 17th, 2000 hearing.
Okay, so she, but she appeared by counsel and not by phone.
That is correct. The court attempted, if you look at the transcript, the court attempted to reach
then,
her.
February 28th, the order indicates that she appeared by phone and by counsel. Is that correct?
Correct.
Then you have the April 3rd default judgment where she, later there's testimony, she showed up at 10 o'clock, but she did not appear, but her counsel was there. Is that correct?
On the April 3rd date, that is
That's
correct.
That's the one that we're really focusing on.
Correct.
And then on April 11th, she appeared by phone again.
She appeared halfway through the hearing. The hearing had taken place, was started. That's correct.
Thank you.
And any other questions on that?
No. So okay. You differ a little bit from this order in the, what is it, seven or eight different appearances. She failed to appear at one pretrial phone conference. Her counsel was there, and she didn't appear at the April 3rd fact-finding hearing on time, but her counsel was there. The other times she had all, the other five times she appeared, four or five times, she appeared either by person or by phone.
That's correct. And I would like the court to note that there are other cases in terms of meaningfully participating. I believe that Christopher D. was looking at that, whether or not a parent can meaningfully participate. And in Christopher D., the court found that the father could participate by telephone in those circumstances. And so that really this is to the discretion of the trial court, whether or not a parent can meaningfully participate by telephone, by their attorney, or if they do in fact need to be available. And this court did in fact order her and give her the oral warnings and say you must be available. I'd like to go back to the point about the default hearing. I want to stress that the default hearing, a motion for default could be brought at any stage. There's an unpublished case that a motion for default was brought after deposition. There wasn't even a fact-finding hearing scheduled. So the default, when, from my perspective as the guardian ad litem, I have an obligation to the court to give the court clear and specific recommendations regarding the best interests of the child. That is at every stage of the proceedings. That is at a default hearing as well. I must be allowed to argue what is in the child's best interest at a default hearing.
Counsel, do you disagree with the premise that the mother has a due process, that due process is entitled to the mother in terms of a fact-finding hearing before her parental
rights when terminated. Do you agree or disagree with that?
In this case, I believe I outlined in my brief the situations with Lair, Quiloin, and also this court in Ray, the interests of JLW, where you look at a different class of parent. And I would argue that, in fact, Tequila could be viewed as a different class of parent, that, in fact, she has not taken on any responsibility, that she is, in fact, a parent similar to those parents, and that, in fact, as I believe Justice Sykes indicated, she has forfeited her due process rights. She has been given, as I think I argued in my brief, her procedural due process rights. But at some point, those rights must give way to the rights of the child.
It seems the question before the court is whether due process can be satisfied.
Chief, may I continue?
Yes. Due process can be satisfied where the default judgment is entered. How can the validity of a default judgment ever be constitutionally scrutinized if there is a forfeiture or a waiver in every default judgment?
I would not indicate that in every default judgment there is a forfeiture. Absolutely not. That's not what I'm saying.
I mean,
in this particular case, I'm asking you to look at this particular case, this mother, these circumstances, which puts this parent into the class of the parent in the Lair, in the United States Supreme Court case of Lair, and in this case, this Supreme Court, I believe it's in the interest of JLW. I would not indicate that in every situation, a default in and of itself, the parent has forfeited her due process rights. But I think that when you look at default, the default in and of itself is, first of all, a parent disobeying the court order. And then secondly, the parent, in essence, is failing to defend. How can we proceed? Tequila, the basis of her argument, as I believe the Court of Appeals decision here said, the basis of her argument, she's got to come forward and say it. She is indicating that she did, in fact, have this contact. She did, in fact, communicate, that she did not abandon him. So how can we proceed without having her present?
Chief?
Yes.
Justice Baxter.
Counsel, the Chief Justice commented about the second proceeding, the fact-finding hearing, and that the interests at stake there are not only the interests of the mother, but the interests of the child. Is the very presence of the guardian ad litem an answer to the protection of the child at that fact-finding hearing? I mean, I think you just said a moment ago that you have the absolute right to put on evidence or demand evidence to be put on. Is that right?
That's correct. At every stage of the proceedings, I would like the justice to note that in Ray, the interest of CEW did limit how the guardian ad litem presents at only fact-finding. That was relating to fact-finding when you're in front of a jury. I think the concern in CEW was that we not be talking about best interests of the child at fact-finding, because really the standard then is that at disposition is the best interest of the child. So, yes, in terms of that my presence in and of itself is something that is at fact-finding, certainly I am representing the child and the child's best interest. But I don't think that this, in this particular case, we were not at fact-finding. And that's why when I was referring to my role and arguing to the court best interest, I believe if there is a default hearing, I must be allowed to argue that. And again, whether it's at fact-finding, at the initial, whatever stage the process is at, when the motion for default is brought.
And your position, if I understand it, is if there's a default, you never have to have fact-finding.
The default, I believe that if, in fact, the court has entered a default judgment, that the default judgment is sound. In other words, there's still an option for the mother here to contest the default, to come back and say, wait a minute, you know, my bus was late, I was in the hospital, whatever. If in fact the default were reopened, if in fact there was a motion brought, that may in fact mean that there would need to be a fact-finding hearing.
I know, but they can enter a default without fact-finding.
I believe that is correct.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Provis, you've got 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honors, could I wasn't paying attention, I'm sorry, when Justice Bradley was going through these hearings. I just wanted to make sure I've got this right. The pretrial conference on December 12, 1999, according to the order that the court issued, my client appeared how?
It was December 21st. The order indicates your client appeared in person. However, your opposing counsel indicated that that was correct and it was by phone.
Yes, that's what the transcript shows, Your Honor. I would only have 2 points in response to the Guardian. First, the Guardian has seemed to indicate that whatever opinion or whatever consideration we're making here is going to apply to defaults and TPRs across the board, and I don't agree. This is a narrow situation, and it is entirely different from the situation where parent has notice and never shows and never enters a plea. This was a contested case, and while it's true, the default statute seems to have that same language, and if that's a different case for you guys to decide at some other point. And then Guardian again raises the issue that under the Lehrer case that client has failed to assume. Well, that was at one point alleged in the petition, but they decided to abandon that ground before decision, and the case was not decided on failure to assume, so I don't think it's fair in a due process sort of way for anyone at this point to be arguing the case can be sustained on failure to assume, because there were no facts presented on that, and client had no opportunity to contest that. Your Honor, I apologize for interrupting it before. I was trying to save time.
Apology accepted.
Thank you, Your Honor.
That's it, counsel.
Submitted, Your Honors.
Right. Thank you. That concludes the argument on 00-1739, In re the Termination of Parental Rights, Jayton S.